does it mean to be smart? It means knowing things, of course, facts and history, places and names, and it means being able to figure things out, solve problems, overcome barriers, and move on to the next thing. By any definition, kids in some families, in some schools, some countries are just plain smarter than others. Why is that? I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we try to answer that question. We follow one author's journey through schools around the world, each with their own flaws, but each raising up kids who seem to be doing better than the average American student. How can Finland spend less on schools and do better? Why does poverty in Poland not drag down their students' learning? Could a Korean model of intensive after-school tutoring ever work here? The smartest kids in the world, and how they got that way. Today on Central Standard, after the news. She straps on her backpack and walks through the dark morning to school. A bell rings, pencils are out, eyes are facing forward. It's the same in Kansas City and Oklahoma and Minnesota, the same in Poland and Korea and Finland. But what happens next? Well, what happens next might just determine how smart she'll turn out to be. Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we look at education, at culture, at parenting, and at the question of why some students are doing better than others. Maybe we tend to think it's about teacher training or time spent with parents or education spending. Maybe that is part of it. But research tends to provide some surprising answers to the question of how students get smart. Joining us to help sort this out today is Amanda Ripley. She's a journalist, an Emerson Senior Fellow in the Emerson Collective, and she's written for Time and other magazines. She's the author most recently of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. And she joins us this morning from NPR Studios in Washington. Amanda Ripley, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. I want to mention that Amanda is speaking tomorrow night at the Kansas City Public Library, the Plaza Branch, at 6:30. You can find more information about that at our website, kcur.org. Amanda, maybe we need to start with a pretty straightforward question. The smartest kids in the world is an audacious claim about any kids. What do you mean by smart?
By smart, I mean kids who are, on average, able to not memorize information, but take information and do something useful with it. So solve a math problem they've never seen before that's related to real-life problems they might encounter, or make an argument in written form that's persuasive and specific. Those kinds of things that we know have become much more valuable in the turbulence of the modern economy. And we now can, to some degree, imperfectly, test these skills around the world. And what we find is that a handful of countries, not most, it's important to say, but a handful of countries are managing to educate virtually all their kids to high levels of critical thinking, this kind of deeper level of learning in math, reading, and science.
Well, and maybe we need to talk about that testing, because obviously there's differences in culture and in language. What sorts of problems a kid might have to figure out are going to be different depending on where they grow up. So how do you establish one measure that applies around the world?
It's not easy, that's for sure. But, you know, various folks have been working on this for decades now, and the tests have gotten much, much smarter and much more sophisticated. The protocols that are used by the OECD in this case, we're talking about a test called the PISA test. And the OECD, which is a sort of think tank for developed countries, now administers this PISA test in 60-some countries around the world every 3 years to 500,000 15-year-olds. So there are representative samples in each country. And they're very careful about how that is done, how the kids are chosen, how seriously the test is taken. And in many ways, it is a far more rigorous test than most of our state standardized tests.
Maybe you should describe a little bit. It's not like the SAT. This is not fill in the bubbles with the number two pencil.
Right. I actually took the PISA test to see, because I was skeptical that it would be possible to measure critical thinking. I mean, it just didn't seem likely that you could do that with a test.
Right. And
there are some multiple choice questions, definitely. But many of the questions require you to write out in long form your thoughts, and there clearly is no one right answer. So you're awarded different points depending on the cogency and how compelling your argument is. So it was really unlike any standardized test I've ever taken, including the SAT. It really did require me to think and to, you know, puzzle over something. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it was the hardest test in the world, but I would say it required me to use a lot of the skills I actually use in my life, not just my job, but my everyday life. You know, like the other day, I had to buy an individual health plan for my family. Mm. I'm a freelancer. So under Obamacare, I had to pick a new plan, which required me to go through, you know, a lot of information and try to compare apples to oranges and figure out deductibles and different levels of plans, all that kind of thing that we have to do a lot right now. Assess risk, compare data, digest a lot of information and try to make some sense out of it. That's the kind of thing that the PISA asks you to do.
Right. You printed some of the sample questions or questions similar to those on the test. And it's things like, why is this graph reliable or misleading, or this sign that might be posted at your workplace, what do you take from it? That sort of question.
Yeah, it was a flyer asking you to get the flu shot, right, to vaccinate against influenza. And it was the kind of thing you'd see in any office cafeteria. And it said, you know, how persuasive is this flyer? Could it be better? Describe specifically what you think. And you had to kind of write a short essay in response. So those kinds of things, you know, are, again, it's not, there's no one single perfect measure. And you have to look at multiple metrics like high school graduation, college attainment, other things, economic indicators. But the PISA test in particular has been shown to correlate with GDP growth. And also it's been shown to be more predictive of an individual student's ability to go to college than, say, report card grades.
Okay, so let's get to it. Who are the smartest kids in the world? Give us some countries. Give us some numbers.
Well, some are the obvious ones, right? Like that you've heard of before, Japan, Singapore, South Korea. And I did focus on South Korea for part of the book. That's one of the three countries I focused on to get a sense of that model, because that is the sort of pressure cooker model for how to get to the top of the world, where kids are studying very long hours. Most of them are going to private after school tutoring. There's a lot of pressure, a lot of focus on the test scores, that kind of thing. So that's one model. Another model, which is the more utopian model, if you will, is Finland, which you may have heard about has, you know, also very high scores, very strong results, a 96% high school graduation rate compared to 77% in the United States, and yet does not do that after-school tutoring. There's many, many fewer standardized tests, a lot less pressure on kids. So that's a more kind of holistic, humane approach to get to the top of the world. And then the third country that I looked at is Poland, which always surprises people because you don't hear as much about Poland. But Poland is a fascinating story of a country that has only very recently risen to the top tier of the world. And in some ways, this example is more relevant to many of our states because Poland has a 16% child poverty rate, which is relatively high, much higher than Finland. And it also is a big, sprawling, messy country with a lot of distrust for the central government and a lot of competing municipalities and some of the same issues that we deal with here.
And I want to walk through kind of each of those countries and each of those models here in a minute. But first, I guess I'm curious why those three countries? You could have chosen a whole lot of other ones to look at.
I definitely wanted South Korea because it's kind of the extreme case of the pressure cooker model. So I wanted to see what that's all about. And South Korea is just a crazy carnival of of education. I mean, there's really no place quite like it where education is taken so seriously. And remember, this, like Finland, is a country that in the 1950s was just, you know, a disaster, I mean, educationally speaking, and has rocketed up the charts. So it's really interesting to see what happened and what it looks like now and what's right and wrong about that model. So that was pretty obvious. Finland was also pretty obvious because that is, you know, the sort of quintessential opposite of Korea, but gets to the very same place. I mean, in the 1950s, Finland had a 10% high school graduation rate, which is, you know, not good. And and so the fact that they've risen to this height without doing some of the more extreme high-pressure tactics that we see in Asia is really intriguing and promising for all of us. And then, you know, I needed to find a country that had just recently made those changes because there's a lot of revisionist history that happens in every country, right? Just like our own country. So when you ask Finns, well, how did you do this? Well, none of them were alive, or some of them were alive when they did this. But there's a lot of, you know, fog that has set in about how that happened. And some of it, you know, some of of that history is fascinating, don't get me wrong, but it's useful to also go to a place that's still in the midst of that transition, where those changes are still very new and very controversial, and see what that looks like. So Poland is a great example of that. All three countries, I wanted them to be democracies and places where you have to deal with, you know, the messy compromise of politics, unlike, say, parts of China where or Singapore, where you can just make decisions and they just happen.
So one of the things that makes your book different, it's not just a sociologist or an education expert looking at these countries' education systems, is that you actually follow American students who find themselves as foreign exchange students in these countries, in these schools. How did you come to approach this topic that way?
Well, you know, I found in my own reporting in the U.S. that it was very easy for me to just drone on and on, like I just have done, about education, and for me to interview a bunch of adults and principals and parents and teachers. And
you're not droning at all. It's fine.
Well, you know, I could just do this all day, right? And many, 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 many education articles do exactly that. You know, you quote the researchers, you quote the adults in the room. But they never talk to the kids. And the problem with that is, A, it makes your story a lot less interesting. But B, you're missing the most important commentator in the world. I mean, basically, kids spend all day thinking about their school, what could be better, not just academically, but also socially. They think about the food in the cafeteria. They have very strong opinions on what they see. And what I found within the U.S. in my reporting is that, you know, I would have a very strong thesis about what was right and what was wrong, what was happening in a given school or classroom or neighborhood. And then I go talk to a group of kids in that classroom, and they would basically just eviscerate my thesis in about 7 minutes. And I'd find out something totally different is going on. So you really do need kids. I have lost the ability as an adult to see schools and to see the world the way they do. And so you really desperately need kids as your sort of field agents on the ground, or else, you know, there's just no the research can tell you a lot, but there's just as much it can't tell you, and you need kids' eyes for that.
Well, we're going to talk about what those kids and you working with them found out. We also want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. Here's a chance, listeners, for you to test your theories. Why do you think kids in some countries are doing better or worse than others, or better than Americans in many cases? Should we worry about this as much as we do? Help us with your theories. Call us at 816-235-235. 2888. We'll put them to the test. 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also tweet at us today. We are at KCURCST. Why do you think kids get to be smarter? We're talking with Amanda Ripley here today on Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. You can follow us streaming live at kcur.org. Amanda Ripley is the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. She went to three countries and spent a lot of time finding out why the kids get smart there. And one of those countries was Finland. Amanda, of all the countries you evaluate, Finland's kids have the highest overall performance. They are the smartest kids in the world. What are schools like in Finland? How are they different?
Finland has the smartest kids per dollar an hour spent studying. So, you know, there are countries that have higher test scores than Finland, although not much higher. But those kids are studying night and day. They're going to tutoring. The cool thing about Finland, the really inspiring thing and almost, you know, unbelievable thing about Finland is that they're getting to the same relatively high place without that kind of pressure and stress and strain on kids. So the important thing about Finland, I think, is less what it looks like now and more how they got there. To me, that was really fascinating. So I spent a lot of time trying to sort that out and asking Finns to research old newspaper clips and that kind of thing. What you find is that Finland, like all of these really these education superpower countries, was at a economic existential crisis point in the 1960s and 70s, where they really were behind in industrializing compared to other Nordic countries. And, you know, there was a danger that they were going to become globally irrelevant in the Western European economy. So there was a lot of momentum to make changes. And one of the things that they did in the late 1960s was to shut down their existing education colleges where they trained their teachers and reopen them in their most elite 8 universities in the country, which was a very wise decision. It's hard to, I think, really estimate how many implications this has. But by doing this, you know, they fundamentally changed not only the labor pool of teachers and how well-educated they were, but the signals they sent out to everyone else about how hard teaching really is and how important education really is. And those signals, once those signals come through and kids and parents and taxpayers and politicians all know that getting into education college in Finland is as hard as getting into MIT in the United States, amazing things flow from that, right? I mean, you can really make the case that you should pay teachers a little more, that you should give them more autonomy and more respect, and really turn it into a 21st century knowledge job, which is what it is.
Well, the student who you followed from Oklahoma to her years in Finland, her name is Kim. She actually, you've posted some interviews with these students on your website, and want to play a little bit of what Kim says. She's talking about how the classroom environment is different in Finland. Let's give that a listen.
I feel like here, they don't try to make it fun. They actually do have fun. And they don't try to make it incorporated into the classroom as a bribe. Like, they don't say, okay, we'll have fun in this class as a bribe. They get their work done, they work, and they genuinely, it matters to them. They have a genuine education. And then they have some fun because they know they've worked hard. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's something that I'll definitely take with me, that school is not necessarily just a rigorous thing you have to get pushed through. It's something that is an opportunity and it should be appreciated.
That was Kim, one of the students that Amanda Ripley talked with while she was an exchange student in Finland. Amanda, you talk about the signals changing over time. It obviously is apparent to Kim that there's a different way of thinking about school and classroom. How does that change in a culture where the practices are ingrained as they are right now in the United States, or for that matter, anywhere else?
Well, on the one hand, it's discouraging, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine that mindset changing. And that's something that the American kids I followed noticed in every country, that other kids seem to care a lot about school. They complained all the time. Don't get me wrong. You know, they complained about the work they were doing. There were teachers they liked, teachers they hated. But they seemed to buy into the basic premise that what they were doing all day long in school would have a direct impact on how interesting their lives would be. And once that connection is made and is real and authentic in kids' minds, everybody else's jobs, parents, teachers, principals, everybody else's jobs get a lot easier. So the good news is that this can change more quickly than we might think, and it often is accompanied by economic pressure. And fortunately or unfortunately, we are experiencing economic pressure in this country. We are getting to a point where it is going to be much, much harder to live a full and stable life without the ability to constantly learn and relearn and rethink and innovate. So, you know, these words are buzzwords we hear all the time. What you see when you talk to employers, even people who run factories around the country, is that they are desperate for more of these skills, that they are happy to look elsewhere if they cannot find them. So this kind of thing requires, this change requires usually an economic imperative. And I think we have that.
We have some great calls on the line at 816-235-2888. What are your theories about why American education is not keeping up with some other countries like Finland or Korea or Poland? 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Frank in Lawrence. Frank, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks. Good morning. Yeah, I want to know, Amanda, did you, in your studies, did you also go into the fact that Finland, Poland, South Korea are much more homogeneous than America? They have very few minority members in their populations, and their healthcare systems are probably much more advanced than in America and than in Oklahoma, for instance, that has a much more broad population mix with minority people, whereas these other countries where you talk about do not. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Frank, appreciate your call. Thanks so much. Amanda, he makes a point. Is homogeneity a factor in why these countries have an easier time with their educational systems?
That's a great question. And for a long time, I actually ignored some of these international comparisons myself before I got working on this, because I felt like, you know, it was apples to oranges. How can you compare the United States, which is a big, diverse country with a significant level of child poverty, to a country like Finland or Korea? But once I started thinking about our country as 50 different countries, if you think about all our states as if they're countries, you see some really interesting and perplexing things. For example, we have many small homogeneous states, some that are much better off, actually, economically than most countries around the world. And yet, you don't see them performing at the level of Finland. So let's take Maine, for example. Maine is 94% white. It is got a quarter of the population of Finland, similar climate, one could argue. And yet, you know, the 15-year-olds in Maine are performing at about the level of the 15-year-olds in Portugal in math. And that is to say, below average for the developed world. Mm. So, you know, despite the fact that we are spending more than all but four countries in the world per pupil, I definitely think that diversity and poverty are very important triggers in this situation. I think things interact for good and for ill to lead to outcomes in complex systems like education or healthcare. So poverty and diversity are definitely part of that. But one interesting thing you see around the world is a lot of outliers. So if you think about Norway, Frank mentioned, you know, the generosity of the healthcare systems in some of these countries. Norway has a much more generous healthcare system. Norway has less than 6% child poverty, which is one of the lowest rates in the world, similar to Finland. Norway shares a border with Finland, right? I mean, many Americans could be forgiven for mistaking these two countries, right? But Norway gets consistently unimpressive education outcomes. They are getting actually slightly worse over time, and their teenagers are performing at about the level of our teenagers, despite the fact that Norway is one of the only four countries that spends more per pupil on education than we do. So these things are complex, for sure, and things interact. And our poverty in particular makes our job here of educating our kids much, much harder. But interestingly, if you look at the top quartile of most affluent American 15-year-olds, so these are actually very well-off kids who, relative to other countries, and they have highly educated parents and computers and all these things, those kids score below their affluent peers in 26 other countries in math. So what you're seeing there is that even at our most advantage level, particularly in math, again, we do better in reading, you're seeing a systemic problem that transcends poverty and race.
Let's talk to John in Olathe as we try to figure out what it is. If it's not the amount of money we're spending on education, what makes the difference? John, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
Glad you're here.
Kim, I was wondering if you could compare the American Scholastic, the time spent on athletics in school compared to Asia or Finland, and what if that has something to do with the low scores in America, the amount of time or the pressure that parents put on their children to go into sports.
Great question for Amanda Ripley, our guest. Less focus on athletics in other countries, does that make a difference?
Yes, that is a really interesting point and something that the American kids I followed immediately picked up on. So they noticed right away that sports were just not a big deal. They were not part of school. So in most countries around the world, kids, of course, play sports, but they play them outside of school. So in pickup games on their own or in, you know, neighborhood leagues or community rec centers or things organized by parents. But it's not part of the mission of high school to deliver 15 different sports to kids. And that is actually a really important difference. This is always controversial to talk about because people in America have very strong, often positive and sentimental memories about sports in high school. But when you look around the world, this does make us quite unusual. I actually surveyed hundreds of exchange students to see if there were patterns in what they found. And 9 out of 10 international exchange students who had lived here and gone to school here said that American kids cared much more about sports than kids in other countries. What you see, for example, in Finland is that kids actually dial back their focus on sports in high school because they're much more focused on taking the end of high school exam, which is extremely rigorous and will determine where they can go to college. So there is this kind of shift in emphasis the older you get. And we see sort of the opposite. We see more emphasis on competitive athletics the older you get through high school, which is obviously a function of the importance of athletics in college. But while athletes themselves, student athletes, seem to do fine and do benefit, I'm sure, in many ways from athletics, the interesting thing is what athletics and the focus on athletics does to everyone else in the school. So About half of kids do not participate in athletics by senior year of high school, and principals nevertheless spend a good chunk of their day dealing with athletics. Hmm. You know, many principals I've talked to in America, most of the meetings they have with parents are around athletics. Let's say their son has been benched because his GPA fell below the minimum that he needs to play, and they're concerned, or they're concerned about the coach or what have you. This principal in America spends a lot of time on this, you know, managing athletic budgets, finding a substitute teacher because the math teacher is also a football coach and he has an away game. All of these things distract from what is actually very hard. It is very hard to run a high-functioning school in America.
Well, one of the schools that you talk about is the one that that Tom, who's the exchange student who goes to Poland, is from. He's from Gettysburg High School in Pennsylvania. He notices the difference because that's a very strong emphasis on football at the school that he came from. Notices it's very different in Poland, right?
That's right. I mean, one of the reasons Tom left Pennsylvania and decided he wanted to go spend a year studying in Wrocław, Poland, which not every kid decides to do.
His senior year.
So it's pretty unusual, obviously. But one of the reasons is that he just wasn't into football. And that was really the lifeblood of the sort of heart of the school culture, as it is in many high schools around America. So he was really into philosophy. And, you know, he had this idea, this sort of romantic idea of what Poland would be like and the smoke-filled coffee shops that he would go to and all this kind of thing. So that's what he did. And when he got there, he noticed that his high school, you know, looked very different from his school in Pennsylvania, which is sort of a middling school. I mean, but it has a beautiful facility, his Pennsylvania school. And you see this a lot in America. Our facilities are generally, not always, but on average, pretty impressive compared to facilities around the world. We have more computers, for example, per student than the developed country average. And even though it might not feel like this, we do invest quite a bit in these kinds of things that other countries care less about. So, for example, his school in Poland not only did not have all the gymnasiums and beautiful fields that his school in Pennsylvania had, but it didn't even have a cafeteria.
And Tom talks about in one of the videos that you've posted online, talks about the difference in technology and why maybe those technological differences aren't as important as we sometimes make them out to be. Let's listen a little bit to Tom talking about his different experience from Pennsylvania to Poland.
Basically, high school just was kind of a stagnant environment for me. Well, I mean, what was important in high school? It's like prom, football games, dating people, and there was no one wanted to actually learn anything, and no one wanted to discover the world or something. I think high school could definitely be more engaging, but it's not a question of how much technology we have in the classroom, of whether we have iPads and laptops, because all of my classes we do have laptops, and in all of my classes we use smart boards. And what do kids do on their laptops? They play flash games, and smart boards don't work all the time. And if they do, then you're not doing anything that you wouldn't do on a chalkboard.
That was Tom, one of the students that our guest Amanda Ripley talked with as she was working on the book, The Smartest Kids in the World, and how they got that way. Amanda, I was a little surprised to see Poland on the list, frankly. We don't think of Poland as an educational stronghold. How are the schools different there, other than having less technology than American schools?
Poland is an incredibly inspiring case study. I mean, this is a country that in the year 2000, not that long ago, 15-year-olds performed below average for the developed world in math, reading, and science on that PISA test that we were talking about earlier. So Polish 15-year-olds were scoring below 15-year-olds in America at that point. And over the last decade, this country has instituted a wide range of reforms, many of which were very controversial. But over that period, they have ratcheted up their outcomes until in 2012, Polish 15-year-olds scored above average for the developed world, way above their American peers. And now Poland has a greater percentage of kids performing at an advanced level in math than Finland, which is remarkable because Poland has far more poverty than Finland is, and is in many ways a much more challenging country from an education standpoint.
I guess I'm also curious about sort of the environment in which students learn. You paint a pretty vivid picture of walking up to the school Tom attends in this fairly small city in Poland. It is not a wealthy enclave. It sounds like, you call it a ghetto, actually. And yet there's something remarkable happening in the classrooms.
Well, it's definitely more austere, and you notice this in the other countries as well, with some exceptions. But, you know, there's not as much technology. You don't see any smart boards or digital whiteboards on the walls. You see far fewer computers. What you do see are, you know, the kind of the usual thing, like a teacher and kids working in a classroom. And that's where we know the real magic happens. It's about people. And technology can help. It can hinder. But fundamentally, your investment in people and training them and supporting them is what matters most of all.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll look at the other country that Amanda Ripley visited, South Korea. There, a very different model of education reigns supreme. We'll take a look at what all of these differences between countries mean for the actual student experience. And we'll take a good hard look at schools in America, where they are succeeding, why, and where they aren't, what can be done. Still would love to hear from you. If you've ever studied abroad, what did you notice that was different? If you've ever hosted an exchange student, how did their experience in American schools differ from their experience at home? Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about the smartest kids in the world and how they got that way. That's the title of the book by our guest, Amanda Ripley. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. this morning. And we are also talking with you. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join the conversation. 235-2888. Let's take a call from MD in Kansas City, Missouri. MD, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Hey, yeah. I'm a high school mathematics teacher and originally grown up and, high school went to Bangladesh. Teaching here in Kansas City past 8 years. As a high school mathematics teacher and having my own education from Bangladesh, this is what I found that our students, typically they are less persuasive and, they are not really careful and they do not face any real consequences. For example, a country like Bangladesh or India or some country that faces British education, kids learn at the 8th grade or 9th grade mathematics. That math been taught in our college here, like 110. And the problem, I think, what we are facing as a nation, that we have more opportunity and kids are not taking that as a serious manner. However, those poor country, what happened, they have rigorous, endless practice. And understanding the fact that, we have GLEs or CLEs, they may go through here in the United States, but kids do not have enough practice to create their own problem and apply those GLEs. So I would, say, there are a lot of opportunity. And that's why our kids do not feel that it is needed. That's why they are careless. The one quick thing I want to tell Amanda that I think the biggest problem we should focus on the grading system. I never ever seen in a country like Bangladesh that, attending a school and participating, you're going to get 10 to 15 points or 15%. I mean, that give you 10% less than any other given country where the student don't achieve them 10 to 15%. Whatever you get correct, whatever you achieve at through your participation, that you should get. You should not get extra additional 15% on participation, and that's what is a standard grading system in this country. So I think as educator, we should focus on that or try to reform, not putting any grade on participation.
Sure. I appreciate that call, MD, and you've highlighted a number of differences between American education systems and, you said, the British system in India where you grew up. Amanda Ripley, do these differences sound familiar, the complaint about getting 15 points just for showing up?
Yeah, there was a Finnish, a girl from Finland, exchange student who came to Michigan for a year. So she was living with a host family and attending public school in a, you know, decent sort of suburb in Michigan. And one of the things she noticed right away was that you got points just for showing up. Exchange students always notice this from all over. And from high-performing countries and low-performing, they're all struck by this amazing generosity of the American system that all you have to do is basically show up, you get some points. And it was something that comes up a lot. You know, when I surveyed exchange students, 9 out of 10 of them said that their U.S. classes were just easier, just straight up easier. And interestingly, 7 out of 10 American exchange students who had lived abroad agreed that the classes in the U.S. were easier. So certainly there is a lack of rigor and a lack of real consequences for many, though not all, American kids. And it's particularly obvious in math. You know, we have gotten to a place, luckily, where in the early elementary years, we treat reading very seriously. And you see a lot of differentiated instruction where teachers are really, you know, grouping kids and challenging them according to where they're at and moving them fluidly up and down those groups in many classrooms, which is awesome. And, you know, they also enroll parents, you know, from a very young age. We're all told, oh, you're supposed to read to your kid and how important that is.
Right.
You see much less of that around math, and that is unusual in many other countries. You know, numbers, counting, puzzles with math are very much a part of parents' interaction with their kids from a very, very young age. So there's a lot of things going on there in what MD said. I do think that there are different ways to get to rigorous learning, and there are some that are just very rote and kind of soul-crushing, and there are, which you do see, by the way, all over Bangladesh and India and much of the world. And then you do see more joyful ways to get to rigor. At the end of the day, though, it does require hard work. It does require failure. I mean, learning at a high level requires making mistakes. And so that is a very big mind shift that has to happen, not only among teachers, but especially among parents. You know, one thing that Tom from Pennsylvania noticed when he got to Poland on the very first day of class, his teacher read out the latest test results, which is very common in many countries around the world. And the highest score you could get was a 5 and the lowest was a 1. And nobody got a 5, he noticed. And he was sort of surprised by that. And all year long, Tom waited to hear a 5 and he never did.
And the teacher read out the scores with the students' names attached?
Yeah, you see this a lot all over the world, even again in low-performing countries where there's less sensitivity about students' privacy, which I'm not sure is a good thing. But there is a kind of sense, much the way we treat sports, that, you know, look, here are your results. That only works if it's combined with a mindset that says you can do better by working hard and getting help. So that's really important. I mean, that's the mindset we have in a lot of our sports, and that should be the mindset we have in math, right? That says, okay, well, if I got a 2 or a 3 and not a 5, it's because I didn't work hard enough and I didn't get the help I needed. So that mindset combined with that honesty with kids is really powerful. Yeah.
You mentioned rigor, and perhaps rigor is only scratching the surface of what you experienced when you saw South Korean schools. Very different from Finland and Poland, right? Are you still with us, Amanda? Well, we seem to have lost Amanda Ripley. We're going to try to get her back. And while we're doing that, we can talk a little bit about what she witnessed in Korea. She talked with a student named Eric. Eric is from Minnesota. He's a high school junior, I believe, who made the journey to South Korea to spend a year as an exchange student. And he noticed immediately the difference in students, talks a little bit about the intensity of those students. Here's a little bit of Amanda Ripley's interview with him.
In Korean high school, home and school intersect constantly. If you're at home, you're either studying, eating, or sleeping. If you're at school, you're studying, eating, or sleeping.
So this is one of the famous sleeping pillows that they have in Korean high school. With one of these, the students can hook it onto their arms during a class and knock out. So students will use this to fall asleep during class. It's much more comfortable than your arm.
That was Eric, a student from Minnesota who's an exchange student in South Korea, one of the students that Amanda Ripley talked to as she was working on her book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. She's our guest today on Central Standard here on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. Amanda Ripley, are you back with us?
I am. Thank you.
Great. I'm sorry that we had a little problem there for just a moment. Eric is experiencing Korean schools. He's experiencing the sleeping pillow that just allows students to nod off during class. Why in the world would so many students need to sleep during class?
He was shocking on Eric's first day of school in Korea. You know, he was in class, trying to play cool and fit in and not embarrass himself. And he looked back and a third of the kids were asleep in his first class. He couldn't believe it. You know, he just had this idea that Korean kids would be very deferential towards their teacher and they would never dare just flat out put their heads down on the desk and sleep in class. But actually, it's very common. I have pictures of it that I took while I was there. And this is a great visual to understand what I mean about there are different paths to get to the top of the world. Some are much more sensible and humane than others. Those kids are sleeping in class because they are staying up so late studying, which is, upside down, right?
Unbelievable. You wrote at one point that Korean teenagers spend more time studying than American teenagers spend awake.
Yeah, that's right. So the typical, particularly in high school, it gets very intense in high school because they're preparing for their equivalent of the SAT or the ACT. And so what happens is kids go pretty long school day, say 8 to 4:30 or so. And then after that, most of them continue studying in various forms of after school tutoring, like test prep academies or on their own or online. And they find a way to continue studying. There's sort of this insatiable demand for more and more lecturing and educating in hopes that you will be one of the lucky few who gets into one of the top universities in the land.
Obviously it works in the sense of getting to high test scores and kids who we would call smart. I guess I'm wondering, in your evaluation of this, are there things more important than being smart, than doing well on tests? Is something being lost in such an intense environment?
Definitely. You know, when you talk to Korean kids who have come to live in the U.S., and I followed one young woman named Jenny who had lived half her life in the U.S. and half in Korea and had just come back, actually, to the U.S., to New Jersey, she is really struck by this. Like, on the one hand, she feels like it's awesome that she has so many opportunities in her American schools. She can do yearbook and she can run track. And, it's much more holistic. And she loves that. And she loves that kids aren't living under so much stress. On the other hand, she also is struck by how little is expected of kids when they are in class. So, one of her first math tests in New Jersey, she noticed that one of the girls was having trouble. One of her fellow students was having trouble. So she raised her hand and she asked the teacher a couple questions. And finally, he just gave her the answer, and she couldn't, it just took her breath away because she wondered, is that teacher going to follow that girl to college? Like, who,
right.
at what point is she going to be on her own? And right. She's seen many things like that since then. So, there are some really impressive things about Korea. This is a country that systematically overestimates what its kids can do, especially in math and science, while we are underestimating at every socioeconomic level, especially in math and science. On the other hand, The danger is obviously that you just, you make kids miserable and you make parents miserable and teachers miserable. So there are other ways to do this. The trick always is to focus on quality of the work over quantity. I sometimes worry that in some ways we look more like Korea. In many ways, we have nothing in common with Korea. But in some ways, by focusing, we for example, our kids do a lot of homework on average. We take a lot of standardized tests. We spend a lot of money. All of these things are about quantity with very little regard for quality. So American kids' average homework is just kind of ridiculous. It's like busy work and packets and just a waste of time. Why are we doing that? We are mistaking quantity for rigor.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. We do want to turn our attention to American schools, how they're different, what they're doing wrong or right in some cases. 235-2888 is the number to call. Charlie in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, hello there. I was an exchange teacher to Poland in the late 90s, and I was amazed at the way things went. Back then, most of the learning was done by rote. The teacher would read to the students from a book, and they would write down notes, and then they would regurgitate that on the test. But they were motivated because they have a mantra during their senior year, which is a test like the SATs. And if they had a good score, they got free college education. And so this was a highly motivated thing. And I had a question for Amanda.
Amanda, you call the mantra the mother of all tests, right, that they're preparing for?
Right, and many countries have this kind of thing, yes, and it's usually much more demanding than our SAT.
All right, so go on, Charlie, I'm sorry.
Well, I just wondered if when in Poland, if she tested the students who just went to the high schools that were college prep, because in the eighth grade, they would track the students, and if they weren't highly good at attaining grades, they were put into either trade schools, or I even lived by a school where the emphasis was on sports, and they just all did sports. So I was wondering if she tested just the students that were college-bound. And the other thing I wanted to point
out
was...
Okay, Charlie, I want to let her address that, and we've got a number of calls to get to. That is a good question, though. Tracking is part of a lot of countries' educational systems, including America, of course.
I'm so glad Charlie brought this up. Yes, so the PISA test, the test that we've been talking about that compares how kids are doing by age 15 around the world, does include kids at all different tracks and vocational, private, public, you name it. It is a representative sample. But that said, an interesting thing happened in the past decade after Charlie left Poland. And one of those things, this is one of the reforms I was talking about that has helped contribute to Poland's victories in education, is that they actually delayed tracking by a year. So instead of separating kids according to ability at age 15 into vocational and university track, they moved that to age 16. And so like 11th grade in our system.
And how does that compare with American tracking practices?
Well, it's so funny because I always thought we didn't really track. You know, we don't have as many vocational high schools as we once did and that kind of thing. But actually, it turns out we track much younger and more aggressively than most developed countries. And we do it in this kind of stealth way. So it starts in elementary school with gifted and talented mm-hmm. programs, right? And then from there, you end up in honors classes by middle school. And then those often lead directly to AP, advanced placement classes. There are other names for these tracks, but they're pretty firm by the time you're in 9th and 10th grade, which is actually pretty early compared to Finland and Poland today. And what you find is that when you do that, everybody seems to do worse, even the kids who are headed to the university track, which is sort of surprising. But all around the world, the longer you wait to separate kids to different content based on ability, the better everyone does, even at the high and the low level. So that assumes a pretty well-trained, well-supported teacher, of course, to pull that off. But what you see is that raising expectations, keeping kids together, has this surprisingly beneficial effect on everybody.
Well, and you also mentioned that there's sort of a de facto tracking system, which is that we send minority and low-income students to basically inferior schools.
I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's probably even a bigger deal than, you know, gifted and talented, right? I mean, because of the way our schools are so segregated based on race, but also on income, you essentially have different tracks based on your neighborhood. And that is something that is extremely unusual today in the developed world. So we are quite inequitable in how we distribute resources for education. I think this is improving slightly in some states, but the recession, you know, set us back a ways in that direction. But, you know, typically in most modern developed countries today, what they say is, okay, who are the neediest kids? Who are the kids who are the most behind and have the most challenges at home? We're going to funnel the most experienced teachers and the best resources to those neighborhoods. And we actually do the opposite. So this is a very big deal. And like you say, does lead to, you know, sort of second class schools all over the country.
816-235-2888 is our number. Michael, you've been waiting a while from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, Amanda, I had a quick question. I, you know, here in America, you have Bill Nye saying that teaching creationism in our elementary schools is hurting our kids' STEM equivalency. I was wondering, are there any correlations between secularism in South Korea and Finland and Poland, although I know Poland is heavily Catholic, compared to America that shows better educational outcomes?
Yeah,
I'll take my answer up there.
Appreciate the call, Michael. Do they debate whether they should teach creation versus evolution in schools in these countries?
That's a great question. I don't think there's a direct relationship between secularism and results. On the other hand, meddling by state legislators and education board of education members is high in many U.S. schools. It is extremely disruptive and inconsistent. And part of that happens everywhere. I mean, even in Finland, there are big debates. Every time they change, they have like a common core, just like we're trying to do in most of our states now, a set of standards for what kids should learn at every grade level. And they revisit it every 5 to 10 years. And every time they do it, there's big fights in the legislature and people can't agree. You know, there's all these kinds of controversies are very normal. On the other hand, what you see in the U.S., because there is so little trust in the education system itself, partly because we educate twice as many teachers as we need in wildly varying education colleges, some of which let in almost anyone and don't do a very good job. Partly because of that, that opens the door for all kinds of meddling, right? Because, you know, some random, you know, state senator thinks that he knows best about what kids should learn. And so that opens the door. Now, if getting into college, if only the top 10% of kids were allowed to even go to education college, and if that training included a full year of rigorous coaching in the classroom with real kids, it might be slightly harder, though certainly not impossible, to meddle at that level.
Well, I mean, and so let's, I mean, in the time we have left, which isn't very much, you are a journalist, you're not a policymaker, but if you were that senator who might be tempted to meddle, instead of meddling, what should they be doing? I mean, how do you... You ask, how do you spot a world-class education? How do we create a world-class education? At this moment in history, what could the United States do? In about a minute.
I would put everything through a quality test. You know, resist the urge to just do more testing, more buying of computers. All this kind of thing is not working for us. We are not getting the return on our investment we should be getting. A much more worthy battle to fight would be to go to your education colleges, the places that train your teachers, and ask, you know, do you have a cut score that's above the national average on the SAT? Because many, 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 many places do not.
Right.
They let anyone in and then they don't get any respect. So this is a cycle that is not impossible to disrupt. I mean, we have districts in this country that have taken on tenure and won. I mean, that's incredible. That's a huge fight. And why not take this on, which actually leads to better results over time?
And if there's one thing you could do as a parent, what would it be?
Oh, this is a great one.
You got five
this
seconds.
Actually changed the way I parent as a parent of a public school kid in D.C. Focus on doing the things that lead to learning. So do less bake sales, less kind of, you know, all the things that your school asks you to do. That's a very American way of defining parental involvement. Focus on reading to your kid, talking to your kid, asking them about their day. That back and forth dialogue is where the learning happens all around the world.
That's Amanda Ripley. She's a journalist with the Emerson Collective, an Emerson Senior Fellow. She's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Amanda, thank you so much for sharing your time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've also posted an essay Amanda's written on the recent changes to the SAT and how they compare to other countries. You can find that at our website, kcur.org/centralstandard. Also, don't miss Amanda speaking tomorrow at the Kansas City Public Library, the Plaza Branch, at 6:30. Reservations can be made at kclibrary.org. Join us tomorrow when we hop aboard the startup bus and look at how police are on the front lines of mental health responders. Both those stories tomorrow. Up to Date's coming up next with Kevin Cook on Kitty Genovese and Missouri Poet Laureate William Trowbridge. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Christy Garten with Kate Baxendale. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.